People First Radio is a program about people, the society in which we live, and issues related to health and wellness.
This is People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh. Today on the program, Unmasking Mental Health. Jessica Ward King talks about her experience with bipolar and the dynamics around disclosure. And Nanaimo High Schooler Rocky Sloan netted a $100,000 scholarship to pursue his dream of becoming a doctor. We'll hear about the work he's been doing connecting with seniors in the community. Welcome to People First Radio. From May 5th to 9th, it's the Canadian Mental Health Association's annual Mental Health Week. This year's theme is Unmasking Mental Health. The CMHA's website says that living with mental health challenges often forces people to hide behind a mask to protect themselves from judgment and discrimination. Jessica Ward King is a keynote speaker and mental health advocate who sometimes goes by the Stigma Crusher. You can find some of her written work on the website of the Mental Health Commission of Canada, where she's often written about her own experiences with bipolar disorder. I reached her in Ottawa to talk about mental health and masking.
My name is Jessica Ward King. I'm also known as the Stigma Crusher, and I hold a PhD in psychology, but I also live with bipolar disorder. And so these two different and complementary ways of seeing the world really color the way that I interact with the world and my environment.
Well, thank you very much for making the time. We're going to be talking today about Mental Health Week. The theme of this year's Mental Health Week is a concept called masking, and I'm wondering if you could help me make sense of what that is.
Absolutely. So I think that the whole theme of unmasking for Mental Health Week this year is a bit of a double entendre. In the one sense, we need to really unmask what it means to live with mental health and mental illness in particular. But on the other sense, and this is a sense that I wrote about in my article for the Mental Health Commission's Catalyst magazine, is the kind of personal journey of unmasking that a person that's living with mental illness has to do as they go throughout life and navigate social situations. Because it is largely a hidden or invisible disability, living with mental illness, you have both the, I guess, advantage as well as the disadvantage of having to make that decision to unmask or to come out each and every time you enter a new situation. And so that's kind of the tack I've taken on it. But it's also really important, particularly like we've just had the absolute tragedy in Vancouver. And one of the first news articles that I heard about it talked about how the perpetrator or the alleged perpetrator of this terrible crime is A, known to police, but B, has mental health issues. And like somehow that violence and those mental health issues are related to each other and that one depends on the other. And so we really need to be unmasking what it means to live with mental illness and to, you know, be to really solidify, you know, the idea in people's heads of what mental illness is really.
In that spirit, is there any context or anything you'd like people to know about your own experience with bipolar?
Yeah, so I've lived with bipolar disorder since I was a teenager, and it was first misdiagnosed because I never went to the doctor when I was feeling manic. When I was feeling really good and had lots of energy, I didn't go to the doctor and say, "Hey, doc, I'm feeling fantastic." I went to the doctor and went to the hospital when I was severely depressed. And so I was originally misdiagnosed for years and years with major depressive disorder. And the treatments for the two disorders are quite different. And so my disorder was made worse by the treatments I was receiving for the major depressive disorder at that time. And so I've really had this journey of self-discovery, of getting a diagnosis of bipolar disorder and coming to terms with what that means. I mean, it's a serious mental illness that is quite different in terms of the stigma and the connotations than, you know, your major depressive disorder, which is kind of seen along with anxiety as like the common colds of the mental illness world. They're much more common. And so bipolar disorder is between 1 and 4% of people have that, and it's seen as a more problematic diagnosis. And so I've had to go through a journey of self-discovery and accepting my own diagnosis and kind of where I fall there and what my treatment plan is going to look like and what my future is going to look like, and you know, whether I was going to have children in the natural way or we ended up adopting instead. And so it's really been quite a journey of self-discovery.
Could you tell me a little more about a couple of parts of that journey? I'm really especially curious about, you talked about for years and years and years, you had this other diagnosis. What happened when that changed?
So it was becoming clear to my doctor. I was then seeing a therapist at the hospital where my psychiatrist was also housed, and my therapist was noticing when I would come in with the high moods, and actually, so the therapist talking to the psychiatrist is really what kind of crystallized this. So the therapist is saying, you know, she's coming in presenting with mania, as well as sometimes coming in presenting with depression. And so I was told, you know, you don't have major depressive disorder, you have bipolar disorder. And initially I was very resistant to that change in diagnosis. It didn't change anything about my experience of the illness. I was still having the same highs and the same lows and the same changes in energy, but it really changed the meaning of what I was experiencing. I was now a person with bipolar disorder, and that had meaning in terms of, you know, what kind of future I could expect to see. We know that people with bipolar disorder live on average 15 years less than the general population. We know that it's a highly, highly heritable disease. And so I was re-diagnosed at the time when we were doing family planning. And so, you know, that really, I was like, wow, I've got bipolar disorder. Do I want to biologically bring a child into this world? And so it really sent me into a tailspin at that time. And I think I think any diagnosis of a mental health condition or a mental illness can do that to a person, because we have such stigma about mental illnesses in our society. I mean, we hear it all the time. I've referenced, you know, the terrible news. Whenever terrible news erupts, it always gets linked to whether that person had a mental health diagnosis, but also just the way that people talk, you know, the crazy psychos and the people who are nuts and one flew over the cuckoo's nest and all those that kind of discussion that people have can be really highly stigmatizing to any mental illness, but particularly a serious mental illness that's associated with psychosis and delusional thinking, like bipolar or schizophrenia. And so that's, you know, that really colored the way that I saw myself and the way that I saw myself in society.
So there's that moment, there's how you were feeling at that time. What's the journey from there to now? You're the stigma crusher.
Yes, so it was a really unfortunate situation that actually led to this crystallization. So I hid my diagnoses from any and everyone that I could. I mean, obviously couldn't hide it from my wife, but I tried to hide it in professional settings. I tried to hide it from friends, even from family members, for years and years. And like, I would go into hospital and I would say, oh, you know, I was receiving treatment for my chronic migraines. I was receiving treatment for whatever else, but anything but mental illness. And then I was teaching, and one of the students of mine at college died by suicide. And unfortunately, the school's reaction to that was a very common reaction. I don't blame anyone for this, but the reaction was, don't anyone talk about suicide. Let's just talk about, you know, this person's life and that they died. And, you know, we'll just kind of gloss over the suicide aspect out of respect for their family, because there is that stigma. There's a huge stigma around suicide. And so it was the school kind of responded by saying, let's just not talk about that. But I could see the rest of the students who had kind of initially, when this whole story of this unfortunate suicide broke, had started to open up and say, you know, talk about their journeys and how difficult it was and how they were expected to be so high achieving, and you know, and if any of them were struggling. And when this news came out with the school saying, let's not talk about suicide, I saw their mouths clamp shut. You know, I saw them going back into themselves. And because my whole journey with mental illness started when I was, you know, a young teenager and went in through my years at university, and I struggled so mightily, I could see myself in them. And I thought, if I can do one thing, I can talk about my experiences, and maybe that will help even one person. Maybe that will help open up the conversation so that one student can come to me instead of, you know, sitting in silence and maybe ultimately harming themselves in some way. And so I started an anti-stigma campaign at the college, and I created a conference. I got, you know, some funding to create this conference. And I opened up about my story for the very first time on that very public stage among my colleagues, among my students, among, you know, fellow researchers. And it was terrifying, but it was also very liberating. Because then when people asked me, you know, how are you doing? I could actually say, not so great. And there would be an understanding there. It was a difficult decision to make, because when you unmask, particularly in a work context or in the context of, you know, your family or whatnot, that follows you around. You can't, once you've come out of that closet, you can't go back in. And so it was a difficult decision to make, but I really did see the conversation about mental health open up after that. And that really, it inspired me to continue to be radically open about my experiences with mental health and mental illness. And when I moved into becoming a public servant, I continued that tack and started speaking with the Federal Speakers Forum on lived experiences and talking to, you know, my colleagues in the federal government and elsewhere as a person with lived experience of mental illness. And it's been, for me, thankfully, very, very positive of an experience. I've had a few haters, but not too many. Most people say, you know, you opening up has really inspired me to be more open about my experiences with mental illness. And it's funny because I've had a couple of people say to me, oh, you know, I don't know anybody with mental illness. And I'm like, nah, you just don't know that they have mental illness because they're still in the mental illness closet. But being able to give people some of the language and some of the reference points to open up that conversation in their own lives has been really empowering to me.
So from that perspective, what maybe advice would you give to someone about the idea of unmasking or like gauging whether an environment is going to be a safe one to kind of drop the mask or disclose what's going on with their mental health?
Yeah. First, I want to say it is not always safe or appropriate to drop the mask. Masking, it is a very valid tactic or way of living to protect oneself, to protect the things that one has and has achieved. There is stigma. There can be negative consequences. Now, I've had the advantage of not really experiencing those negative consequences in my career. I haven't had that experience, but I do know people who have. And so it's not always appropriate to drop the mask. The ways that I have found to engage, and I have to continue to make that decision when I go into new jobs, when I go into new social situations, I have to continue to make that decision to drop the mask. And the way that I try to gauge is, how are people talking about experiences of mental health and mental illness? Are they using highly stigmatizing language like, oh, those crazy cuckoos over there, or, oh, you know, you're gonna you're acting like someone who's really OCD, or, you know, this political climate is super bipolar. Like, are they using language in a way that is not appropriate? We don't always have the best language, but you can really kind of gauge by like how people are talking about experiences of mental health and mental illness.
You're listening to People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh. My guest is Jessica Ward King, AKA The Stigma Crusher. She's a mental health advocate and keynote speaker based in Ottawa. She's opened up about her experience with bipolar disorder. It's the Canadian Mental Health Association's Mental Health Week from May 5th to 9th. We're talking about this year's theme, unmasking mental health.
You can also test the waters a little bit by kind of floating something out there, like saying something, whether it's true or not, something, but like, oh, my aunt was in a psychiatric facility, and see how people react to that. They're so like, oh my gosh, do you let your children go over there? Then you know it's not necessarily the safest environment. So those are a couple of ways you can do it. You can also, bring up news stories or things that you've seen in the media, and see how people react to it. I find that quite often the way that people react in public settings versus in more private settings can be very different. And so while some people won't say anything about stigmatizing language in a group, they may, come to you afterwards and say, I have a daughter or I have a friend who has the experience of mental illness, who lives with depression, who lives with anxiety, or even I myself also have anxiety, and, talk to you on a more one-on-one level in terms of how that works for them. And I find that it can be a lot easier to unmask in that one-on-one setting with someone who's a little bit more trusted, who you know a little bit better, who you've talked to a little bit more, and kind of test it out that way. And just, make sure if you do it that way that you tell the person that you want to keep this in confidence between yourselves. See if it goes any further than that. Generally speaking, I would hope that it wouldn't. And so you can kind of more safely unmask in a one-on-one level rather than, going on the radio and saying you're the stigma crusher or getting up in front of all of your colleagues and giving a presentation. That can be really quite daunting for a lot of people.
On that last run in particular, how do you think people should approach this when it comes to their workplace or their employer, that idea of disclosure?
Yeah, and so as I say, there is a lot of stigma, and quite often stigma is rooted in ignorance and fear rather than in any like particular ill intent. And so you can expect to come up against stigma. And in the workplace, how that often manifests is that people have the best of intentions. If they know that you're struggling, they don't want to give you the juicy files. They don't want to put added stress on you, and so they'll pull back. And that can happen from managers and senior leaders, as well as from colleagues. They with all of the greatest intentions, don't want to further stress you out, but that results in you not getting the opportunities for advancement, in people questioning why you need leaves of absence, even if it's for vacation. They think, oh, are they off on mental health leave and all that kind of thing. So it's not always the safest thing to do in the workplace. There are some institutions as well where you might expect there to be more concern. So if your workplace is somewhere where you are keeping the public peace, for example, like a correctional facility or in a police force, or if it's in a legal context in terms of being a lawyer or something like that, you may expect that there's more concern because those are really high stress, high intensity environments where you need to be on all the time. And so those are places where you might be led to think twice about disclosure. Now, as I had mentioned, it can be quite freeing to disclose and to be able to say to your colleagues, in response to, how are you doing, to say, not a great day today. I'm having a rough day today. Do you think we could move the meeting to tomorrow, or to next week or whenever? So it can be freeing in that sense, but it's very much a personal decision based on, where you're working, what the attitudes seem to be in that place of work, and how solid you are as well with your employment. If you are on probation, or if you're not tenured, or if you're in some way, if it's a tenuous bit of employment, you again may want to think twice about it because the stigma may be there. So it's very much a personal decision. It's not that masking is bad. I really want to stress that masking is not itself bad. It's a very adaptive strategy for living in the world that we live in. But as I say, it can be also adaptive to come out from under the thumb of that stigma and that masking, and to be able to be honest with at least one of your colleagues.
On the other side of that equation, if I am the colleague, how can I first of all, make someone feel like this is a safe space for them to be able to talk about whatever, to disclose whatever is going on. And, you know, if and when they do that, how can I make sure they feel good about having made that decision?
Absolutely. So the first thing I would say, and I mentioned it before, is language. We don't always have perfect language for talking about mental illness. It's been stigmatized for so long that we don't talk about it. We don't always know exactly what are the politically correct terms. But just be cognizant of the language you're using. And so don't use terminology that is, you know, psychiatric diagnoses in particular. We hear those used like, oh, I'm so OCD, I just really like to organize things, or, oh, you know, these politicians are so bipolar, or using the word like talking about, oh, you know, he committed suicide, it's so selfish of him. So watching the way that you use language, watching the way that you talk about mental illness, to be sensitive to the fact that the person that you're talking to may have a lived experience of mental illness, or may and definitely does have someone in their life that they love that has experience of mental illness. By the age of 40, half of us will have had a mental health concern. So the chances that, you know, that you ever find a person who doesn't have someone in their personal life that has lived with mental illness, practically nil, right? So always consider that the person that you're talking to may have that intimate and lived experience. Another thing is to be able to talk about the people in your life that are living with mental illness, to be able to refer to, oh, my daughter, she lives with anxiety and she was having a really rough day. And to really go about and crush that stigma as much as you can. That signals to the other people, if they're looking to unmask, that signals to them that you are a safe person to unmask to, because you're willing to talk about those lived and living experiences of mental illness in your own life. You don't have to necessarily, just word vomit every experience you've ever had, but just kind of making sure that, especially if someone that you're talking to, if you suspect that they might be struggling, and you ask them, how are you? And you get the perfunctory, I'm fine. It's absolutely okay to say, yeah, okay, but how are you really? You know, underneath it all, how are you really? And that person then has the opportunity. They can say, no, I'm fine. And you can believe them or not, but you can just continue on. Or that really gives them the opening to say, you know what, actually, not so good today, you know, and that opens it up for someone to be more open and to unmask themselves a little bit to you. That said, prying is not a very good tactic here, like saying, okay, how are you really? And they continue to say, I'm fine. You don't want to say, oh, but I've noticed you're not. How are you really? You know, give that person enough grace to decide for themselves whether they want to unmask or not. But just opening it up, giving that little wedge in the door can be so instrumental. And I've even found that when I've been hesitant to come out to a colleague, if I get that opening, it makes it so much easier, so much more natural to be able to unmask.
So knock on the door, maybe even give a little wedge, creak it open a little bit, just make sure not to kick it down.
Exactly. You've got it.
You're tuned in to People First Radio. I'm speaking with Jessica Ward-King, mental health advocate and keynote speaker, who sometimes goes by the Stigma Crusher. In today's conversation, she's spoken a bit about her experience being diagnosed with bipolar disorder. Here's some information from HealthLink BC on the condition. Bipolar disorder is an illness that causes extreme mood changes, from times of very high energy, or manic episodes, to times of depression. Many people with bipolar disorder show only the symptoms of depression. The cause of bipolar disorder isn't completely understood, but experts believe many factors may be involved. It tends to run in families. HealthLink BC describes bipolar 1 as the classic form of the illness. It causes episodes of mania and depression that keep coming back. In bipolar 2, you will have depression as in bipolar 1, but the manic highs are less severe. people with bipolar 2 have more episodes of depression than mania. When you have bipolar disorder, you have highs and lows of mania, hypomania, and depression. In between, you may return completely to normal, or you may still have some symptoms. The extreme mood changes may come on all of a sudden or appear more slowly. During a manic episode, you may go from feeling abnormally happy and productive to behaving irresponsibly and sleeping very little. After this manic high, your mood may return to normal, or you may feel useless and extremely sad, and you may lose interest in things you've enjoyed in the past. At first, stress may trigger depression or mania, but as the illness progresses, mood swings may not be caused by any certain event. Without treatment, your bipolar disorder may get worse. This can cause you to move more often between mania and depression. That information was from HealthLink BC. Now back to my conversation with Jessica Ward King, aka the Stigma Crusher. As part of the kind of framing of our conversation, I might try to include some of the HealthLink BC, for example, information about this is what bipolar disorder is. These are some of the things that can accompany it. And I know you shared a little bit about your journey already, but is there any important context you think would be good to include alongside that from your own experience, the kind of things someone might not get about it if they're just looking at the kind of clinical information?
Everybody's experience of their mental illness is going to be a little bit different. So the way that we diagnose mental illness is based on a collection of symptoms where, like, for example, for major depressive disorder, you have to have one of either depressed mood nearly every day for 2 weeks or anhedonia, which is not enjoying things that you normally do. And then there's a laundry list of like 9 other things where you have to have, a few of those other things. And so 2 people with major depressive disorder can look very different. They can either overeat or they can undereat. They can oversleep or they can undersleep. They can have problems with cognition and thinking and doing tasks, or they can have, excessive guilt. And they may or may not have suicidal ideation. It really can vary. And so one thing that I think people mistake is that if they know one person with mental illness, that they'll know exactly what to look for in other people. And that's just not the case. And so that's something that's really important to know, is that, that my bipolar is not going to look the same as Selena Gomez's bipolar disorder, or, any other of the stars that have come out and said they have bipolar disorder. They're going to look very different. So really listening to what a person that is struggling with that mental illness or living with that mental illness says about their experience, rather than what you think you know based on someone else that you've heard of or read reports, or even someone else that you know personally. But really listening instead to that person's lived experience. And that's why it's so important that we call it lived and living experience, because those experiences are going to be different for every person. That's really important context to note. Another thing I would note is if you could link to the 988 suicide helpline that launched about a year and a bit ago here in Canada. That's a really important, it's really there for people that are living with suicidal ideation, or people who love someone who's living with suicidal ideation and wants some advice on how to speak with that person and how to get them help if that's necessary at the time. It's there for suicide awareness and for suicide help, but people with other mental health disorders can also call, and because suicidality is a feature of a lot of mental illnesses. And so if you could link to that as well, that would be really helpful.
On that front, there's that specific resource you just mentioned. I'm wondering if either in your own life or your experience as a keynote speaker, talking to people after the fact, maybe, what would you suggest to someone who might feel like they're really struggling with something, they want to get help, they don't have experience necessarily navigating systems of care, and the idea of that is a little intimidating? What would you say is a good place to start?
It's a lot intimidating. That absolutely is. I remember when I was first navigating living with mental illness, and I didn't know, what it was and what to do and who to talk to and how to get help. Your first port of call is generally your family physician. Now, I know in the province that I'm living in Ontario, there are a lot of people wandering around without a family physician because we just don't have enough. I don't know if it's the same in BC or not, but there really just aren't enough family physicians in my province, but I think in this country in general. And so you may not even have that trusted relationship with one particular physician. And the idea of going into a walk-in clinic and talking about your mental health is really super daunting because you've only got like your 10 minutes, and how do you get all of this out in 10 minutes? The risk of not going and getting help, though, is even greater. That's how you end up untreated, without any supports, without any assistance. That's how it ends up getting worse and worse. And we know that treating mental illnesses early, that has better outcomes than when we wait and treat them when they're much, much worse, and you end up, in the emergency room, with suicidal ideation, for example. That can be much more difficult to treat. And so getting help early is really, really important. Getting help for children, if you're seeing signs of mental illness in children, that's really, really important. And so what I would recommend is finding someone trusted in your life. If you're a young person, please try to find a trusted adult. That could be a teacher, a guidance counselor, an aunt, an uncle, a parent, of course, even a family friend. And disclose what you're going through with them, and they can help you navigate the mental health system. It's really difficult when you are struggling with your mental health to do that navigation, to figure out who to talk to and how to talk to them, and if they recommend medication or therapy, how to navigate that. Having someone that is trusted with you, that is not in the throes of that difficult situation, can be really, really instrumental. So find someone you trust and disclose to them, and ask for their help in navigating the system. And now your first port of call, as I mentioned, is a primary care physician, so either your family doctor or a walk-in clinic or somewhere. They can get you a referral if necessary to either a psychiatrist or social worker, a mental health care worker, and get you connected to the right community supports. So we don't have we I mean, in Canada, we're very, very, very fortunate to have public health care, but it's provincial public health care, and so the systems are different. Mental health care is very often done in the community, and so you'll find that it's different from city to city, region to region, and that can make it even more confusing. So getting linked in with your primary care physician is the first step to getting linked in with all those other services. Medication is often a first line of defense, and so a primary care physician is very able to diagnose a mental illness, and prescribe appropriate medications. And if you respond to those, great. If you don't, that's when you may need specialist care, like a psychiatrist in the community, to help you out.
Bringing us back to that whole idea of masking as a theme for Mental Health Week, even the idea of kind of unmasking, if you will, to a doctor at a walk-in clinic sounds really stressful. But maybe it is a takeaway, don't necessarily think about this idea of unmasking as, oh, I'm at the pub with all my friends and it's time to rip the mask off, but start with that trusted person, that close confidant.
Exactly. And find someone, as I say, in your life that you can trust, that you can open up to, that you can talk to. They may not be an expert in mental health, but they may be able to help you look online, look up your symptoms. Don't try not to Dr. Google diagnose yourself. But of course, when you're having these experiences, you're going to go online, you're going to try to find other people who have similar experiences, and that can be really empowering. Being able to put a word or language to what you're experiencing can be really empowering. And so I would encourage you to do research on your own and to get that trusted person that you're talking to help you do the research, and to be that objective third party that can look and say, I've also noticed, because a lot of our diagnostic symptoms for mental illnesses can be noticed by other people. Like, for example, with bipolar disorder, oh, I've noticed that sometimes you have high energy and you are really happy. I know that's not something you go to the doctor for, but I've noticed it, and it's a bit different. And so those kinds of, outsider views can be really helpful as well.
This is People First Radio. The Canadian Mental Health Association's Mental Health Week runs May 5th to 9th. This year's theme is Unmasking Mental Health. Keynote speaker and mental health advocate Jessica Ward-King explored the topic in a piece for the Mental Health Commission of Canada, where she spoke about some of her own experiences with bipolar disorder. You may have heard the term masking used in the contexts of autism or attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. On that subject, Autism Canada's website says that masking happens when an autistic person tries to emulate their neurotypical peers. They may, for example, copy speech patterns, pick uncomfortable yet socially preferable clothes despite sensory issues, or avoid stimming in public. Masking may be a choice an autistic person makes to fit better with a group, but it may also be imposed by parents, peers, and/or educators. Masking may prevent ostracization, but it may also lead to autistic burnout, as a person spends a lot of energy to act in a neurotypical way. Masking is often non-conscious. In Ward King's piece about unmasking mental health and Mental Health Week, she also spoke with people on the autism spectrum and with experience of mental health conditions, including schizophrenia and anxiety. You can find that piece online by searching for its title, Masters of Disguise No More. Is there anything else about even just the idea of mental health in general or having conversations about it that you think it's important to bring to one like this?
I think that it's important to note that even though we've come a long way in terms of talking about the narrative about mental illness in our society, the stigma is still there. And so we have this idea that, well, we talk about mental health more than ever before, and we do. We have Mental Health Week. We have, in fact, May, the entire month is Mental Health Month in Canada. And so, people kind of have the idea that the problem is solved. We're talking about it. But only talking about it on a certain day or a certain week or even a certain month and then forgetting all of that for the rest of the year doesn't solve the problem. And when you see disheartening reports like the ones coming out of the tragedy in Vancouver just today, and you see that violence being linked to mental illness, when we know instead that people with mental illness are much more likely to be victims of violent crime than they are to be perpetrators. We know, for example, that being male is much more associated with violent crime than having mental illness. And yet we certainly wouldn't say all men are therefore going to be violent, right? But we tend to do that with mental illness. And so I think it's really important to note that the stigma is not gone. And just having, a Let's Talk Day or a mental health day doesn't erase the stigma. It's still there. It's still very real for people living with mental illness and their loved ones. And we have a lot more work to do.
On that front, a theme that's come up in a number of conversations I've had on the program over the last 6 to 8 months has been almost exactly what you're saying. Earlier in our conversation, you mentioned things like anxiety, depression. You compared them to sort of like the common colds of the world of mental health discourse. And that's not to diminish how serious anxiety or depression could be. But there, it feels like there's like an extra layer of stigma that still persists when it comes to things like bipolar or obsessive compulsive disorder or schizophrenia. And I'm wondering if there's anything specific you think people need to know about that idea or that we could do to like lessen the negative consequences of that.
Mm-hmm. I think, and when I say you're very right, and thank you for bringing up that when you say it's like the common cold of the mental health world, it's not to diminish the suffering and the severity of those disorders. It's just that they're more common. And so people have a bit more of an entry point. It's more likely that someone that you know and love is going to have anxiety or depression than it is that they're going to have psychosis, like schizophrenia or bipolar. bipolar disorder or something like obsessive compulsive disorder or even post-traumatic stress disorder. And so those disorders tend to be shrouded in more secrecy, in more, again, I'll say the word stigma, in just more ignorance about what those disorders really look like and what the experience of living with them really is. And so I think one of the ways to demystify those is through what social psychologists call contact. So getting people that are living with those disorders and listening to them and listening to their experiences and learning about their experiences. And we can do that in mass media ways through documentaries, through listening to the experiences of celebrities that come out and say that they have these disorders. But even with you know, especially something like schizophrenia, it tends to hit very young. And so young people that are before they've become famous or before they've become, you know, credible are struck with the disorder. And so you don't often hear of a star coming out and saying, I have schizophrenia, because generally speaking, they would have been affected by that disorder, you know, often before they even became famous. And so finding the people with lived experiences and listening to their stories is so important, because that contact that you get when you meet someone with the disorder and you listen and you hear their lived experience, it can be very transformative for a lot of people. People will say, wow, you know, I had no idea that someone with schizophrenia or with bipolar disorder could be so articulate, could be so intelligent, could be so sane and normal. Because, you know, normal in great big air quotes, because what is normal these days? But, you know, there are lots of people who live with these disorders, but also live very, very typical lives that have, you know, husbands and wives and children and jobs and, you know, success in life. And we just don't tend to associate that with severe mental illness. So giving people the space to unmask can give you that experience of contact with someone who is living with a mental illness.
Jessica Ward King, thank you so much for taking some time to share some of your experiences today.
Of course, happy to do so.
Mental health advocate and keynote speaker Jessica Ward King speaking about unmasking mental health. That's the theme of the Canadian Mental Health Association's Mental Health Week, which runs from May 5th to 9th.
This is People First Radio, coming to you on CHLY 101.7 FM in Nanaimo, on CFMH Local 107.3 FM in St. John, and on CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria.
Nanaimo High School student Rocky Sloan started a program to help seniors in the community. Now, he's earned a scholarship of up to $100,000, which he plans to use to help him become a family doctor. Sloan is one of 36 new Loran Scholars from across the country. Founded in 1988 as the Canada Merit Scholarship Foundation and renamed the Loran Scholars Foundation in 2007, the program offers stipends for tuition and living expenses and can be used at 25 Canadian universities. I met up with Sloan outside of Felice Cafe in Nanaimo to chat about his work in the community and his plans for the future.
My name is Rocky. I am a grade 12 student at Dover Bay Secondary School, and I live in Nanaimo, BC.
And the reason for our conversation today is pretty recently you found out you're going to get $100,000 up to. What is the deal with this scholarship?
Well, this is a, like you said, $100,000 scholarship, but it's more of a leadership program stretched over 4 years for undergraduate students. Although they do give you money, it is also a lot of work that you have to put into it. And there's a lot of learning and training and passing on knowledge to younger students that comes with the award.
Talk to me about the goal, like what you're hoping to do with this, what the program is aiming to kind of help you get to.
Okay. Well, I would say that every scholar in the program is someone who's devoted to their community and wants to help make the world a better place in their own way. That is exactly the type of thing that I'm looking to do as well. I'm looking to grow and network and learn from the experiences of others. And each person is going to take the knowledge and the skills that they've gained in the Loran program and then apply that to their own field. I think that's what makes the Loran program so special. It's so interdisciplinary. It stretches between so many different career paths, and the alumni really hail from like so many different areas of our society. Yeah, it's the goal of the Loran is just to find students who are devoted, who will help make the world a better place.
Do you have any idea of how you're hoping to do that? How you're hoping to make the world a better place?
Me personally, I really want to go into medicine. It is my dream to become a doctor. Right now, I'm thinking family medicine. Hopefully come back and work here in Nanaimo after I get my MD. That's just what I have right now. I'm definitely flexible if that needs to change.
What's the story on why you wanted to become a doctor?
Well, when I was 11, my family was in a serious car accident, although thankfully not fatal. I was airlifted to the BC Children's Hospital, and they performed emergency surgery on me. And I was told afterwards that I was very lucky to be alive. And I just think that the kindness and, you know, the way I was treated by the staff there, it really moved me. And it showed me just how valuable the medical profession could be. I think before that, I didn't really consider the impact that I could have on other people's lives as a doctor. For context, my mom is a doctor, but before I was in the hospital, I didn't really realize like how important that job was. I just saw it as like, oh, you know, mom goes to work and she comes home every day. It moved me. Mm.
And I understand you've already started volunteering in the community at medical clinics. Can you tell me a little bit about that work?
Mm-hmm. So Students for Seniors is a program that me and my friends started. We partnered with a medical clinic in town that I've had the privilege of previously working for, so I kind of had an in. And we, it's hard to describe. We're not a medical program, so we focus on performing tasks and services that seniors used to be able to do, but then as they got older, they can no longer do, hoping to keep them out of assisted living. And now, again, we can't do any sort of like medical care, but the things we do, we go grocery shopping for them, we take them on excursions, we clean their gardens, we reach things on high shelves, stuff like that. Just small things, things that we can do for free.
So the idea is maybe there are seniors at this clinic already who are patients of the clinic. Maybe their doctor or someone notices that they might seem like they could use a little bit of help, or maybe they see the signs in the clinic or something, and somehow they get connected to you and you touch base and see, like, how can we help?
Absolutely. That's exactly it. Yes.
Tell me about how that work has been. Like, why did you decide to start doing that?
Well, when I was first working at the clinic and then also at my time working at a pharmacy, there were a lot of seniors in town that I got the privilege of talking to. And I don't know, it became very obvious to me, not only just like how many seniors needed a little bit more support, but also how much support was needed in terms of like loneliness. And Students for Seniors really started as like a service to talk to seniors and just like go for walks with them and just spend time with them. And then it really morphed into like doing services while we did that. So not only are we going to come over and have a cup of tea with you, but we're going to help you reach something or clean the top shelf, et cetera, while we do it.
What's the impact that you've seen from doing that work?
Me personally, I've just built like the best connections with some of my seniors. They've taught me so much through their advice and their knowledge and just sharing with me their life stories. And I'd hope that I've taught them things too, like things about our current society and things about my generation. Sometimes I think the real benefit of Students for Seniors is helping the two generations understand each other more.
What do you find are the most common things that come up over and over again?
Definitely chase your dreams. Almost every senior I've talked to has said that there was like a moment in their life where they did something practical and they regret it. They wish that they had done something more whimsy, more whimsical, more unrealistic. They wish they had chased that dream or just gone for it, taken that risk.
So we're here, we're talking about, I guess, you chasing your dream in some way. Are you getting this $100,000 scholarship to go to med school, hopefully one day? What is the path like to do that these days? How do you get into med school? What do you have to do first?
Mm-hmm. So to get into med school in Canada, you have to do 3 years of an undergrad degree, at least 3 years, although a lot of people do four. there's no one program that you have to do to get into med school. You can actually go with any other program as long as you meet the prerequisites. Although I am hoping to do a health science program at either Queens or McMaster in the fall, which is like a specific program for kids who are interested in health professions.
This is People First Radio. My guest is Rocky Sloan. He's a student at Nanaimo's Dover Bay Secondary. Sloan was one of 36 students across Canada to recently receive a $100,000 Loran scholarship. Sloan plans to study medicine with the hopes of one day becoming a family doctor. While he was in high school, which he still is, he started a program connecting students with seniors in the community who could benefit from help with chores and some connection. I met up with Sloan outside of Nanaimo's Felice Cafe. Could you tell me a little bit more about the application process for this scholarship and what you had to do?
For sure. It's definitely rigorous. So it starts off with this kind of like lengthy essay section. There's four essays and then a bunch of short answer sections where they want to hear all about your extracurriculars and about, you know, about your extracurriculars, yes, but also how you've grown from your extracurriculars. At least that was my perspective. And I really feel like that was a consistent theme throughout the whole application process. So Loran really focuses on how your extracurriculars have benefited you and the community instead of just the things you've done, how they've changed you, and how you're going to use that to continue benefiting in the future. After we submit our general application, I think 500 people across the country got sent videos or invitations to make a video. So how that worked is they just kind of like give you a question, 10 seconds to read it, and then they turn on the camera and you have a minute and 30 seconds to just answer it. And there were four of those videos. And then after that, they ask, I think, 250 people across the country to go to semifinals, and that's divided by region. And then those are held online on Zoom. And afterwards, the people who move from semifinals to finals are flown to Toronto for the Loran National Selections Weekend, which this year was held at UTM. And that was really cool. That was an experience in itself.
Ooh, tell me more about the experience. When you get flown to the finals, what did you have to do?
Well, on top of the interviews, there were also a lot of workshops and stuff we did. I think the idea was that even if you don't move forward, just making it to finals would be really beneficial for all of our future endeavors because you just learn so much. They teach you a lot. Just being there is like an experience that I will definitely be taking with me to the future. I learned a lot.
So how did you find out that you got this?
They called me. Yes. 1 week after I left the National Selections Weekend, they called me and I was in my room and I picked up the phone and the woman on the other end sounded really empathetic. So I thought I maybe didn't win it. But then she told me that I did win it. And I was just so in shock. I just kept thanking her over and over again. And then I told my mom.
So what is next? I mean, we've talked about like the long-term plans, the long-term goals. We've talked about some of the path to get here, but like what's next for you with the rest of your time and in Nanaimo in secondary school?
In Nanaimo, I'm really trying to just enjoy my last second semester and I'm just like continuing with my extracurriculars and I'm focusing on my friends and just enjoying the weather and just like appreciating the place that I live before I move to Ontario for the next 4 years. Yeah. With the Loran, we have a couple of workshops, virtual workshops coming up. And then in August, we have a 1 week retreat, which is where all of the Loran scholars go on a canoe trip in Ontario. So we canoe out, we camp, no phones, and then we come back. And then there is it's like kind of like a couple days where all of the Loran scholars and some of the alumni come and then we can ask them questions and learn from them. And it's the beginning of our leadership training in the program.
Earlier on, you were talking about the loneliness epidemic, if you will, or the idea that there are, at the very least, the idea that there are a lot of seniors out there in the community who are lonely. Beyond like a program like yours, are there other things you think could help contribute to alleviating that?
Other than programs like mine, it's interesting you say that because I feel like programs like mine, the important thing about them is not the program themselves, but more about the mentality of just helping other people in your community. And I think that you definitely don't have to start like a small organization to do specific good. All you have to do is have that that perspective and go through your day looking at how you can help someone who you know would be in need. Focusing on helping your neighbor, etc.
Do you find when you're doing work with students for seniors that there's a particular thing that's causing loneliness out there?
It's hard to say. I would definitely say that the seniors that we work with in Students for Seniors are of a specific caliber. We often see seniors that are relatively healthy, but don't really have any family nearby to take care of them. So while in my experience, there is a serious loneliness epidemic amongst seniors, Students for Seniors, I would say, is definitely skewed in the perspective, because if these seniors had family members or other close friends who could help them, then they wouldn't need our services on a regular basis.
Any idea what's going to happen to Students for Seniors while you're away in Ontario?
That's a really good question. It's kind of up in the air right now. I have some plans for who's going to take over, but it is a little bit difficult because the connection with the medical clinic was through me originally. So we're working out the kinks. Hopefully it's going to keep going after I graduate.
If folks are listening to this around Vancouver Island and they say, man, you know what? Maybe I should do something like that, something to have a positive impact. Is there a message you would have for anyone like that?
I would say that, like, when I started Students for Seniors and similar things, I was really nervous. But over time, I realized that most people are just, like, so kind and filled with gratitude that, like, most of the nerves will burn away. And I honestly think that the seniors have almost done more for me than I've done for them. Honestly, and I think that anyone else who does something similar will discover the same thing.
In what sense?
In the sense that they've just taught me so much and they've really shaped my life perspective up until this point. And I just genuinely cannot even think of who I would be without their advice and their stories and their kindness.
Rocky Sloan, thank you so much. Congratulations again and good luck in Ontario.
Thank you so much.
Rocky Sloan is a student at Nanaimo's Dover Bay Secondary School. He started a program called Students for Seniors, and he's recently won a $100,000 Lorand scholarship, which he says he plans to use to help him on the path to studying medicine and one day becoming a family doctor in Nanaimo. That is it for the show today. This has been People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh. Thank you so much for tuning in. I hope you can join me again next week.
People First Radio is a community media project of Vancouver Island Mental Health Society and produced in Nanaimo, British Columbia. The opinions expressed do not necessarily represent the views of Vancouver Island Mental Health Society or its broadcast partners.